The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerker's Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
The professor is in. Send your questions for Professor Kevin Gutzman to constitution@veritasradionetwork.com.
And welcome to this edition of the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. I am your host and moderator, Mike Church. This is the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade channel. This show debuts on Thursdays at noon, so if you miss any of the episodes and you'd like to go back and catch up on the archives and all the great Constitution info that you may have not been able to hear live, it's easy to do. Go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com and sign up for a Founders Pass membership, and that will gain you access to all 10 now, previously 10, of the episodes of the Constitution Hour. They'll all be at your fingertips, and you can download them using a streaming download service or listen to them online using the Founders Pass media player, and you would have access to all of them commercial-free in full broadband stereo at your leisure. So go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com and sign up today to become a Founders Pass member, and you will be on your way to enjoying not only the Constitution Hour, but Reverse Deception with Greg Carpenter and the Mike Church Show and the Mark Kreslin Show and many others right here on the Crusade Channel. We'll now go to our guest, or host, rather, and that is Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman, who is standing by, as he always is, and he's really champing at the bit this week because we're going to go all the way back to 1798 and unravel a mystery of sorts. Actually, we're going to solve a mystery of sorts that has previously or heretofore been told incorrectly. Kevin, this could be one of the this could be a groundbreaker here if people have not read, and I suspect that most of them haven't, the Journal of the Early Republic from winter 2015, right?
That's right, Mike.
And what we're going to do, folks, is we're going to delve into an essay, and I'll just read you the title, Reassessing Responses to the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions, New Evidence from the Tennessee and Georgia Resolutions and from Other States. Now, I'll just do a little bit of narrative here and try to set the reason up why this may be important, because some people may think, well, why would I need to know about that? Well, I'll tell you why you would need to know about that. Because when the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were authored and then passed in their respective states in 1798, the popular account of what then happened was that the other states either didn't respond to them or wrote letters or passed resolutions saying that they disagreed with them. And therefore, the issue of state interposition was, you know, it's kind of funny, right, Kevin? Because interposition was nullified because of the reporting of the events. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I think that's true. And actually, the standard version we have is entirely partisan and dates to 1948. So basically the way to understand this is that in academia or among professional historians, we have three kinds of audiences. One kind of audience is composed of a general public to whom we speak and for whom we write. Then there's a second audience, which is composed of our students whom we teach. Finally, there is the audience of fellow professional historians. The last group we address chiefly through papers given at historical association conventions and through articles published in peer-reviewed journals. Now, one reason why the history profession's scholarship is at a significantly higher level than, say, the scholarship of the legal academic community is that professional historians publish in peer-reviewed journals. So, in other words, it's only other experts who can give a green light to publishing whatever I've written for a history journal, while in legal academia, it's second-year students who decide what's published, and essentially these are people who don't have any expertise at all. But anyway, the chief journal in the field of the early Republic, that is from the ratification of the Constitution through, say, Lincoln's election, is called the Journal of the Early Republic. There's also a very prominent journal of early American history, which goes essentially from Columbus to 1820 or so, called the William and Mary Quarterly. And both of these journals are involved in our story here. In 1948, the William and Mary Quarterly published an article about the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798. This article was written by Adrian Koch and Harry Ammon. Those were two prominent academic historians of the middle of the 20th century. What Koch and Ammon did in that journal article was somewhat remarkable, and that it would be was foreshadowed by the, I think, unique editorial introduction that was prefaced to the article by Koch and Ammon. So before you got to this article by Koch and Ammon, you had two pages of the editor of the journal telling you why this was significant. And what did he say about it? What he said was that the William and Mary Quarterly was happy to be publishing this article because it showed that President Harry Truman was right in his argument with Virginia Senator Harry Flood Byrd about the nature of the Constitution. So, in other words, the William and Mary Quarterly was taking a position about this internecine squabble within the Democratic Party's top reaches between Senator Harry Flood Byrd and the president. Byrd was insisting on a Jeffersonian reading of the U.S. Constitution, under which the federal government had only a few enumerated powers, and the states, not the central government, had the primary responsibility for protecting people's rights and ensuring that they had Republican government and so on. And on the other hand, Truman was constantly trying to extend the assertion of central government power that had been embarked upon by his predecessor, Franklin Roosevelt. So here we have the William and Mary Quarterly weighing in on this question of the rightness or wrongness of Harry Flood Byrd's Jeffersonian model of the Constitution. Now, the article that Koch and Ammon wrote has been extremely influential. In fact, that was in 1948, and I would argue that all the way down to the present, with the exception of present company and a few other scholars, people have generally turned to the Koch and Ammon article from 1948 anytime they wanted to know what the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions meant, anytime they wanted to understand the relationship between the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and the actual Constitution, anytime, in other words, they wanted a real explication of the Jeffersonian stated position on the Constitution. What Koch and Ammon said in their 1948 article is really remarkable. And the evidence they left out is also really remarkable. So maybe a little bit of explanation about the resolutions themselves. The resolutions, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798, were adopted by the state legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky as representing the views of the official views of the people of Virginia and the people of Kentucky. The issue at hand was that the federal government in 1798 had passed legislation, or the Congress had passed legislation, and President John Adams had signed legislation making it a federal crime punishable by a significant fine and substantial term of imprisonment to say anything that tended to bring the federal government into ill repute. So if you said something negative about the Congress, about the government generally, about John Adams, you might find yourself in prison. In fact, there were 25 people who were indicted under the Alien and Sedition Acts, under the Sedition Act, that is. There were over a dozen trials. In every case in which the trial went to a verdict, the defendant was convicted. And the people who were thrown in prison under the Alien and Sedition Acts for saying things that were critical of President Adams or of the federal government generally included the publisher of the most important Jeffersonian newspaper in the country, the Philadelphia Aurora. And remember, in those days, Philadelphia was the nation's largest city, and a congressman from Vermont named Matthew Lyons. So Vice President Jefferson thought that it was entirely likely that if they had their dreams come true, the Federalists would find some way to prosecute him under the Sedition Act. And in fact, it's startling now, and you know, you laugh involuntarily, but we have, for Jefferson's lifetime, over 30,000 documents in his hand. We have letters, we have inventories, we have a book, we have translated books, we have all kinds of things that Jefferson wrote. He started collecting them when he was a teenager, and he never stopped until his death at age 83. But for 1798, especially for the summer of 1798, we have almost nothing. And why is that? Well, a clue is given us by one of the few things that he actually did write and keep in 1798, a letter to his friend James Madison, in which he told Madison to be sure to check the seals on his letters. So what was that about? Well, in the old days, there weren't envelopes, there weren't mailing envelopes, and instead what a correspondent would do is buy a large piece of paper, write on a particular corner, write his letter in a particular corner of that large piece of paper, fold the paper up in a particular way so that effectively it was serving as its own envelope.
Right.
And then he would take sealing wax and put it on the back of this homemade envelope, and then he would stamp, if he were somebody like Jefferson who had a significant amount of money, he might stamp his own seal on it. So Jefferson famously had a ring with TJ on it that he used. And so when Jefferson told former congressman, chief author of the U.S. Constitution, a chief author of the Bill of Rights, James Madison, to be sure to check Vice President Jefferson's seals, what he meant was that Jefferson thought, that since every postmaster in America was a Federalist, it was entirely plausible that the postmasters might be reading his Jefferson's mail, so it was possible that those letters would arrive at Montpelier or wherever Madison happened to be with the seals already broken. And Jefferson thought this was possible because he figured that probably the Federalists were going to monitor his communications in hopes of finding something critical from him about the government for which he could be prosecuted. So, if you were the Republican high command, if you were Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or Wilson Carey Nicholas or one of the Breckinridges from Kentucky, if you were one of these people who were at the top of the Virginia political pyramid, what could you do? You couldn't go to Congress and ask them to repeal the law. You couldn't get President Adams, who had signed the bill into law on July 14th, 1798, and of course the significance of July 14th wouldn't have been lost on anybody, right? It's July 14th. Today remains the chief national holiday in France because it's the day that the French commemorate the sacking of the Bastille. And that was a significant time of commemoration for Jeffersonian Republicans in 1798, too, they being supporters of the French Revolution in general. So you couldn't go to federal judges and ask them, please, to hold that the Sedition Act was unconstitutional because they were very energetically enforcing it. In fact, there were several of them who did things such as during grand jury charges, telling federal grand juries that, well, it was necessary to enforce the Sedition Act because there was this man out there who was opposed to private property and he was opposed to God and he was going to overthrow the American Republic. And, of course, that was referring to Thomas Jefferson. They're also pardon me?
No, I was going to say, I've heard you tell this story before. They were referring to Thomas Jefferson.
That's right. And actually, there was another case. There was an actual case in which one of the federal judges, a Supreme Court justice named Samuel Chase, had been writing circuit, that is, had been serving on an intermediate level appellate court, which used to be one of the duties of Supreme Court justices in Annapolis. And he told people in Maryland that when he got to Richmond, he was going to find the author of a particular book, and he held the book up. He said, I'm going to find the author of this book. I'm going to impanel a grand jury. We're going to indict him. He's going to be tried. He's going to be convicted. And then he's going to receive the maximum sentence. This was all before there had even been any grand jury convened. So when Chase got to Virginia, he did have the marshal assemble a grand jury. He did have this author, James Callender was his name, indicted. He did have him tried by a petit jury. And in fact, during the jury trial, he interrupted witnesses for Callender. He heckled and berated the lawyer, defense attorneys, one of whom resigned from the case because of the judge's behavior. And ultimately, when the jury came back with a verdict that said, well, in light of the evidence you've allowed us to hear, we have to find him guilty, he threw the book at him. So this was the kind of behavior that Republicans could expect from federal courts, in other words. So Jefferson and Madison, their coadjutors, met at Monticello in the summer of 1798. That is Jefferson's house near Charlottesville, Virginia. And they came up with the idea of having the state legislatures intervene, or as Jefferson put it, falling back on the state legislatures as on the last ditch. So that's why there ended up being the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions in the first place. Well, Koch and Ammon say in their article that this was a novelty, that having the Virginia and Kentucky legislatures intervene this way in federal politics, having them make the claims they made for the role of state entities in the federal political system was something that Madison and Jefferson had never imagined before, but they were staking out the ground they were going to stake out in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions in defense of civil liberty. So that actually was the subtitle of the 1948 article in the William & Mary Quarterly. What did then Virginia and Kentucky say in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions? Well, they said that the federal government had been created by the states for their own purposes, that it had been given enumerated powers, that whenever the federal government adopted a policy that was unconstitutional and dangerous, and these are the words of the third of Virginia's resolutions, the states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose. Okay, now what did interpose mean? Well, that's an interesting question. It has long been the position of nationalists, that is, of people who argue that the American Constitution created a centralized government in which the central government has the primary authority, and it's up to the central government to decide what its authority, what the extent of its authority is, essentially. It's long been their assertion that when Jefferson, Madison, Virginia, Kentucky said that the states had the right and are in duty bound to interpose when the federal government adopts a policy that's unconstitutional and dangerous, interposition, the act of interposing was just rhetorical. In fact, when he was an old man in 1832 and 33, James Madison said that by interposition, they hadn't contemplated anything more than simply adopting resolutions or maybe voting in an election. They hadn't intended for it to involve anything more than that. And here they, in fact, this goes back to the 1948 article by Koch and Ammon. Here they make a distinction between interposition and the word that Jefferson used in his draft Kentucky resolutions, and that was nullification. Jefferson wrote, a nullification is the rightful remedy. Madison, in the 1832-33 period, when South Carolina actually was going to nullify federal statutes, said, well, you know, number one, Jefferson never used the word nullification. And number two, nullification, interposition, these are different, actually. It was embarrassing to Madison that during the nullification crisis of 1832 and 33, Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, produced the original draft of the the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 in Jefferson's own hand. And right there was the word nullification. So there was no doubt that at least Jefferson used the word nullification, which seems in itself to have a particular meaning. And the one of the irritating things about the 1948 article in the William Mary Quarterly is that Koch and Ammon just assume that Madison's 1832-33 explanation of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798 was accurate. That is, that he was not making a different kind of argument in the 1830s than he had made in the 1790s. So I, years ago, over 20 years ago now, published an article in the Journal of the Early Republic showing that Madison actually, his description of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798 during the nullification crisis of the 1830s was just inaccurate. And in fact, this article that I published 20 years ago in the Journal of the Early Republic is now widely cited. So it's, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning books and others have used my argument that Madison really changed his position in the 1830s because he thought that the tariff issue with which South Carolina was concerned was not so significant as to be worth breaking up the Union over, as the freedom of speech and freedom of elections had been in the 1790s.
Right. So to clarify that for people that may just be joining us, so what you mean is that 1832 Madison is being is inaccurate, right?
Yeah, 1832-33 Madison was just wrong, and he was exposed as making things up by Jefferson Randolph, Thomas Jefferson's grandson. And besides that, the language of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions was inconsistent with what Madison said, even if you just had the resolutions themselves. What they said was that each state was responsible for, the states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose, said the Third Virginia Resolution of 1798, within their respective territories. Well, Madison claimed in 1832 and 33 that Virginia and Kentucky were only looking to interstate cooperation. But if interstate cooperation had been their goal, they wouldn't have said that each state was responsible for preventing, for interposing within its respective territory. That looks like an individual state's action. In fact, I don't know any other way to see the idea that, say, Georgia was responsible for preventing enforcement of an unconstitutional and dangerous federal statute within its respective territory that has anything to do with cooperation. But anyway, as far as the introduction that the editor and that of the William Mary Quarterly gave to that 1948 article and his just frank avowal of a partisan political purpose in publishing it, one could see in Koch and Ammon's article that it clearly had been calculated for partisan purposes. Do you want to take a break at this point?
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to turn my...
This is the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. We here are here on the Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel. And the story that we have begun to tell here is one of mystery and intrigue, but actually is one that corrects some serious, serious faults in the historical record. And the faults actually were installed into the record by, as we just learned, none other than James Madison himself. So, when we return to the Constitution Hour, we'll get right back to this discussion here. And remember, if you miss any of the episodes of the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman, you can always download them at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. If you are a Founders Pass member, and to be a Founders Pass member, you can sign up by the month or by the year for as little as 23 cents per day and gain access to all 10 of the Constitution Hour episodes, all 20 of the current episodes of the Mike Church Show, the Mark Kreslin Show, which are live on the Crusade Channel, and much, much more. Please go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com and sign up for a Founders Pass today. We'll be right back here on the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman.
If James Madison were still alive, he would listen to the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Kevin Gutzman. Debuting every Wednesday at noon Central, here on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.